Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the rare bill Senate Democrats and Republicans agree on, which is expected to pass handily on Tuesday, an injection of $250 billion in government support for private industry to improve the U.S.'s competitive edge with China in semiconductors, artificial intelligence, robotics, quantum computing, and other advanced technologies. Scott Kennedy, chair in Chinese Business and Economics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, who has been traveling to China for 30 years and is the author of The Business of Lobbying in China, joins us. We will discuss this unusual agreement that has Republicans voting for government subsidies, spurred on by a fear that a failure to act now would leave the U.S. dependent on its biggest geopolitical rival. We will also assess how competition with China could be managed constructively without necessarily having to resort to conflict. Then we'll go to Mexico City for the results of congressional elections over the weekend, the culmination of a campaign season that has seen 96 politicians and candidates assassinated following a change in strategy by President López Obrador, who came to power promising hugs, not gunshots. Joining us to discuss the results and Vice President Harris's upcoming meeting with López Obrador on Tuesday is Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, who is a professor at the Shah School of Policy and Government at George Mason University and the president of the Association for Borderland Studies and the author of Los Zetas, Inc., Criminal Corporations, Energy, and Civil War in Mexico. Then finally, we'll examine the incendiary and volatile politics in Israel as Prime Minister Netanyahu borrows from Trump, accusing the opposition government about to replace him of fraud, as Shin Bet, Israel's FBI, issues a rare warning that mob violence incited by Netanyahu could result in a January 6th type of lethal uprising. Gershom Gorenberg, an historian and journalist who is a columnist at the Washington Post and a senior correspondent with the American Prospect, and author of Shalom, Friend, The Life and Legacy of Yitzhak Rabin, joins us to discuss Netanyahu's history of using incitement for political gain. And joining us now is Scott Kennedy, a senior advisor and trustee chair in Chinese Business and Economics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a leading authority on China's economic policy and its global economic relations. He has been traveling to China for almost 30 years, and his books include The Fat Tech Dragon, Benchmarking China's Innovation Drive, Perfecting China, Inc., China's 13th Five-Year Plan, and The Business of Lobbying in China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Kennedy.
Thanks so much, Ian. Good to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And on Tuesday, the Senate is expected to vote and pass a rare bipartisan bill, which will inject about $250 billion in government support for private industry to improve the U.S.'s competitive edge with China in semiconductors, artificial intelligence, robotics, quantum computing, and other advanced technology. So that in itself is pretty unusual, isn't it? I mean, the Republicans are normally dead against government subsidies, but why are they all joining hands with the Democrats on this one?
It's an interesting mix that gets us to this combination, because you could see there are Republicans who are fiscal conservatives. There are also Democrats who are against corporate welfare. Yet Democrats and Republicans have found common ground on China, because China is now viewed most importantly as a national security challenge to the United States and as an alternative ideological competitor with an authoritarian state capitalist system that's challenging the U.S.'s own system and the liberal international order on which our success has been built. That trumps the worries of spending too much or giving too much money to industry.
So given that this is in response to fears about China, and fears mostly of all of the United States could become dependent upon China, and of course we recall when the pandemic struck, the U.S. had no PPE and masks and N95s, et cetera, and they had to turn to the Chinese. And there's quite a lot of derisive comments in the Chinese press about the poor Americans that we're helping out, etc. So is this why it's happening, this fear that the U.S. could be dependent on its chief geopolitical rival?
I think that is part of what got the discussion going last year on a lot of this. The pandemic was really a wake-up call for a variety of Americans and Republicans and Democrats and a lot of folks inside the Trump administration. The Trump administration actually had been divided on what their goals were. The pandemic kind of brought everybody together. I think, though, what we are seeing is less a view that this bill is a vehicle to decouple with China than that the U.S. needs to engage in its own effort of self-strengthening. And so more R&D at home, more manufacturing, more diversified supply chains, but not outright decoupling from China. Even in the sectors that you mentioned in healthcare, although we're dependent on China for certain parts of healthcare, including PPE, there's others where China is less important. And what we have is a global supply chain issue. And actually, because of China's manufacturing prowess, in many areas, it will be part of a supply chain resiliency solution. So I do think that the fears about China are motivating a lot of this. But the outcome, I think, of this legislation, if it's implemented appropriately over a long time, is a more resilient American economy, not one that is just decoupled from China.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Kennedy, who's a senior advisor and trustee chair in Chinese business and economics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a leading authority on China's economic policy and its global economic relations. He has been traveling to China for more than 30 years, and his books include The Fat Tech Dragon, Benchmarking China's Innovation Drive, Perfecting China Inc., China's 13th Five-Year Plan, and The Business of Lobbying in China. But you've been arguing, Scott, that the U.S. should see the competition with China managed constructively without necessarily having to resort to conflict. Now, Xi Jinping seems to have changed his tune a little away from the wolf warrior diplomacy of, you know, talking about the Australians as being a piece of gum stuck on the sole of your shoe, to talking about projecting love around the world. So what's happening with Xi Jinping?
Yeah. I don't think that Xi Jinping's comments in the last few days of following a Politburo study session suggesting that China sort of try and improve its global image is about China changing fundamental course. The Chinese themselves view that they are in a strategic competition with the United States, that the U.S. is not going to accept a communist state capitalist China as an equal, and that the U.S. is going to try to squeeze them. And as a result, they are engaged in their own campaign for technological self-reliance, for proving that the Chinese system can deliver better than democratic market economies. And so he may be changed. I think their argument is that people don't understand China well enough. And if they did, they'd like them. And I don't think that's the case. And so I think that this effort to polish their reputation isn't going to last very long. That said, I don't think that the appropriate U.S. response because of China's nefarious behavior and long-term plans is that we cut and run. We can compete and coexist with the Chinese because we have huge advantages with our own system that make this a competitive exercise that we can do very well in. And I'd be happy to talk about any of those elements with you.
We'll talk a little bit about the need to avoid a Cold War, which I take it is your position, that we should have a competition with China, but it shouldn't necessarily resort to conflict.
Well, I don't know of many folks inside the Beltway or outside the Beltway who want war with China. I certainly think we ought to do the best that we can to try and avoid open military conflict, but we need to defend our allies and friends in Asia along China's periphery and the global institutions that support free market democracies. And if that gets us involved in greater conflict with China, then we'll have to defend ourselves. That said, there are areas, I think, where we should feel that because of the strengths of our system, we can compete with the Chinese quite well. I think in high tech, in the competition for talent that drives the research and innovation into high tech, the U.S. has tremendous advantages there. And so I think if we have some more confidence in our system, which I think is justified, we will be able to do quite well and avoid the most nefarious kinds of military conflict that some are predicting are inevitable.
And a lot of those predictions involve Taiwan, where the Chinese have been more aggressive in confronting Taiwan with aircraft flying into Taiwanese airspace, etc. And it's not entirely clear what the United States would do if China resorted to an invasion. So that's not in any way resolved, is it? What kind of dialogue do you think is going on? Because there have been a couple of long phone calls between Xi Jinping and Joe Biden.
Yeah, I think, Taiwan has to be one of the most worrying scenarios for possible U.S.-China conflict and open war that exists. South China Sea, a North Korea collapse crisis, or a North Korea missile launch or something the Taiwan case seems to be more possible. But I still think the guardrails that we've put in place over 50 years ago are still working. The U.S. is still, through military sales and interaction with Taiwan, counterbalancing China's growing military power. Others in the region, from Japan to South Korea to those in Europe, have signaled that they wouldn't necessarily get involved in a military clash, but the consequences for their relationship with China would be extremely high. China would have to be betting its entire political future on the outcome of the war, and that is in doubt. I think as long as there's doubt in their minds, and we haven't foreclosed the possibility of some type of political rapprochement between Taipei and Beijing, that still the likelihood of war is relatively low. And so I still think that that's possible to achieve diplomatically with deterrence as well.
Well, let's turn to something that could really turn the U.S. relationship with China, which is pretty fraught at the moment, into a real deep freeze. And that would be the consequences of investigations that are finally happening now into the possibility that there was a lab accident at the Wuhan Institute for Virology that caused the coronavirus pandemic. And President Biden's given the intelligence services 90 days to come up with something more definitive. What happens if it is finally understood, and it certainly seems likely, that the cause of the coronavirus pandemic was a lab leak at the Wuhan Institute of Virology? I mean, China got really furious with the Australians a while back for even suggesting there should be an international inquiry into the origins of COVID. And they punished Australia with tariffs on beef and wine, etc., basically killing the export business in those commodities. So what would you expect would happen to relations with China and the U.S. and China and the outside world if it were revealed that a lab accident is the cause of the pandemic?
Not good for the relationship, not good for China for sure. China is putting a lot on this that the lab is not the source of the virus, no kind of lab leak or bioweapon or anything like that. What we don't know is what the real answer is right now. Despite lots of rumors and thinking, I don't think that the U.S. intelligence community has given the president anywhere near clarity on this. And I think given what happened in 2002 and 2003 with Iraq, the world deserves to have super duper clarity on this before reaching any conclusions. And then if it does turn out that this lab was the leak for whatever, wow, I think many different options are on the table in terms of sanctions and will fundamentally affect China's relationship with countries around the world, given the extent of the pandemic. But we're also going to have to figure out how to end up, you know, bringing the current pandemic to an end and preparing for future pandemics. And so there's dealing with COVID-19 is partly about the history and the sources of the current pandemic, but there's so much more that we're going to need to do in addition to that.
Well, just in closing, it's not going to be easy to get the Chinese to cooperate. In fact, it's unlikely they will.
Absolutely. This is not, of course not. So the intelligence that's going to have to be gathered to come up with something more definitive will be a monumental task. It's probably way more difficult than looking for Iraqi weapons of mass destruction.
Well, Scott Kennedy, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been great to talk to you.
Well, thanks again, Scott. And again, I've been speaking with Scott Kennedy, Senior Advisor and Trustee Chair in Chinese Business and Economics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a leading authority on China's economic policy and its global economic relations. He's been traveling to China for almost 30 years, and his books include The Fat Tech Dragon, Benchmarking China's Innovation Drive, Perfecting China Inc., China's 13th Five-Year Plan, and The Business of Lobbying in China. We're going to take a brief station break and back and go to Mexico City to look into the results of the congressional elections over the weekend in an election season that's seen 96 politicians and candidates assassinated. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, who is a professor at the Shah School of Policy and Government at George Mason University, whose research focuses on U.S.-Mexican relations, organized crime, immigration, border security, and human trafficking. A global fellow at the Wilson Center, she was recently the principal investigator of a research grant to study organized crime and trafficking in persons in Central America and along Mexico's eastern migration routes, supported by the Department of State's Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons. The president of the Association of Borderland Studies, her latest book is Los Zetas, Inc., Criminal Corporations, Energy, and Civil War in Mexico. Welcome to Background Briefing, Guadalupe Correa Cabrera.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be with you and your audience.
Well, thank you, Guadalupe. And Vice President Harris, today, Monday, is in Guatemala. Tomorrow, Tuesday, she'll be in Mexico City meeting with AMLO, who just suffered a blow in the midterm elections over the weekend. The full count's not in yet, but it looks like he has lost about 60 seats, so he won't have a supermajority and of the 500-person Mexican Congress. So let's begin with that. Do you think that these elections, and obviously I want to talk about the enormous amount of violence involved in these elections with close to 100 politicians and candidates killed, but let's start with AMLO's fortunes or misfortunes. How do you read the election results?
Yes, of course. It's a very interesting subject because the international media is saying what happened yesterday as a big blow against the a presidency of Andrés Manuel López Obrador and his project of the Fourth Transformation in Mexico. And he didn't express any preoccupation at all, because in reality he never had the supermajority that some media are talking about. He definitely, you know, him and his allies, I'm not talking about the party, yes, lost some spaces, but they kept a majority, you know, enough to do what he wants to do, which is to have the budget, to approve the budget. He doesn't need to generate any alliances with anybody to approve the budget, because with him and his allies, that were voted for the project of the Fourth Transformation, he's going to be able to do what he wants to do, which is continue his social programs. So in that regard, and he expressed that today in the mañanera, in the morning, you know, press briefings that he gives, he was happy. He was not unhappy about this. And another thing that it's interesting, because the media portray this as a big loss, and I am not sure about that. Morena won at least 10 governorships. They were not present in 10 governorships. So it seems that we can see it in a different way, depending on in which side. Absolutely, yeah, I think that the main issue, where the main losses were connected to the elections in Mexico City. Several mayorships were lost. And this is where the party had bigger losses. But in reality, he will be able to complete his plans to achieve this Fourth Transformation, maybe by the increase in social programs as he would like to. And, you know, political violence characterized a portion of that process. But at the same time, this is not the first time. You know, political violence or violence connected to politics and organized crime is not new. It has been taking place, you know, during the past several years, and particularly the elections from 2018. The number of incidents that connect political violence with organized crime were higher than in this election. That does not mean that Mexico is undergoing a very, you know, stable situation, but we need to qualify the alleged loss that Andrés Manuel had. What I am hearing in Mexico, I'm Mexico City right now, you know, connected with what his supporters are thinking, they're not sad. It's just like they expected that. What happened in Mexico City is that in Mexico City, the party had a lot of divisions within. The Morena party had a lot of divisions. So more than others, you know, being disillusioned with Andrés Manuel, maybe it had to do with a lot of political divisions and bad selection of candidates. You know, some of the states that were not won by Morena were, you know, in the north. For example, I'm talking about the state of Nuevo León or the state of Chihuahua. They had always been bastions of the PRI or the PAN, but at the same time, the selection of candidates were not very, very good. And also, we have to understand that, you know, the presence of Morena in the north had never been as it is today. So there were a lot of successes in these midterm elections for Andrés Manuel López Obrador.
And again, I'm speaking with Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, who is a professor at the Shah School of Policy and Government at George Mason University, whose research focuses on Mexico-U.S. relations, organized crime, immigration, border security, and human trafficking. A global fellow at the Wilson Center, she was recently the principal investigator of a research grant to study organized crime and trafficking in persons in Central America and along Mexico's eastern migration routes, supported by the Department of State's Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons. And she's the president of the Association for Borderland Studies, and her latest book is Los Zetas, Inc., Criminal Corporations, Energy, and Civil War in Mexico. So, Guadalupe, though, nevertheless, 96 politicians and candidates have been assassinated in this campaign that began in September of last year. And also, there were some horrendous examples just south of us here in Tijuana, in Baja California, where a severed head was tossed at a polling place, etc. Is this in any way a referendum on Manuel López Obrador's different kind of approach to the war on drugs and the war on crime in Mexico? He's tried to change the approach with what he calls hugs, not gunshots. That doesn't seem to be working. So is there an attribution there to this change in not going to war against the cartels, but somehow trying to improve conditions so that young Mexicans aren't forced to join these criminal gangs?
Well, his approach of, you know, hawks, not bullets, has not given the results that were desired, or that are desired by Andrés Manuel López Obrador and in his administration. However, we need to consider the fact that during the past two administrations, the levels of violence were increasing exponentially. In the first year of Andrés Manuel López Obrador, following those trends, you know, we see an increase. Now we're seeing a small decrease, but I don't think that this, you know, this exactly what we're seeing right now with regards to security has solely have to do with Andrés Manuel López Obrador's administration and his approach to security, his strategy, security strategy. There has been like the dynamics that have taken place because of what was, of the security strategy, the militarization of public safety in Mexico really caused this, increase in arms, being in hands of cartels to fight the federal forces. So he bet that he was going, not confronting directly all the cartels was going to be, you know, giving probably, you know, faster results. It has not given the results that he wanted. But we have seen in the past year, I would say, a very slight increase in the number of homicides, which is like, you know, it's there. And there is a problem, a limitation with regards to the security strategy itself. It doesn't seem to be a concrete plan, and the National Guard does not have a concrete mandate. And this is where the problems are. I think that the confrontation against the cartels was perceived by a very important segment of the population as the cause itself of the very big increase in the number of homicides in the country. You know, the war on drugs itself, the militarization of security strategy, caused over 200,000, people dead and 10,000, thousands of disappeared people, doses of thousands of disappeared people. So I definitely think it's a failure to some extent, but not as some groups or some analysts have posed, because you have to understand that the situation of Mexico is not just the result of Andrés Manuel López Obrador's strategy. However, it's his responsibility to address this issue, and in that regard, he has not been successful to address it properly.
So just a week ago, López Obrador said the country is at peace. It's being governed. There are no risks of instability. What do you make of that?
Well, there is instability in the country. There are several states that are, you know, not controlled, but with a very strong presence of organized crime. And, you know, civil society is not safe in a number of municipalities in the nation. You know, what happened, which was represented in the election, is that, you know, people were able to vote. They were able to express their opinions. They participated. Over 50% of the people voted. You know, there is instability, yes, but the country's out of control, no, which is true. But of course, the events that took place, for example, in Baja California, the heads that were thrown there, and some other violent incidents, you know, are a reflection of a violent country, but not of a country out of control. You know, in a way, he wants to say there's no problem, which is an exaggeration. But at the same time, it would be exaggerated to say that Mexico is a failed state.
So let's touch on Vice President Harris's trip to Guatemala at the moment, and Tuesday in Mexico, meeting with President López Obrador. She's not going to Honduras or El Salvador. I take it because the leaders there are just so manifestly corrupt, she can't, you know, even be seen with them. At least that's an assumption on my part. Not that the leader of Guatemala is squeaky clean himself. So how is she doing? Because this is an incredibly difficult task that President Biden's given her, to somehow make life more livable in the Northern Triangle countries so that immigrants won't be forced to flee north to the U.S. border. I don't imagine he set her up to fail, but she's got quite a task in Guatemala. And then, if you don't mind, we'll also talk about what her task is in Mexico City. But let's start with Guatemala.
Absolutely. I think, and this is important to consider, that the approach to irregular migration, I mean, the way that the Biden administration is dealing with this and the future plans, in my opinion, is very relevant. Addressing the root causes of undocumented immigration and having a close connection and an attitude of collaboration, of cooperation, more than pressure, is very appropriate. And this is the way we have to think of. I think in that regard, yes, she's been given a very tough task to do. But I think she has the capacity to do that because, you know, it seems that there is a mandate. She understands that, and she might be able to do it pretty well. Of course, the biggest challenges here are the very high levels of corruption of these countries. But in that regard, there are also plans to address, you know, the causes of corruption and corruption itself by involving civil society, which is interesting. You know, I think the plan of the Biden administration is extremely relevant. And if it is managed correctly, and if corruption is really eroded, corruption is fought appropriately, I am sure things will be better, because definitely if we don't address root causes in the countries of origin where irregular immigration, you know, origins, we're not going to, I mean, there will be on the routes, there will be a lot of, you know, abuses and, you know, the vulnerability of people, you know, present them very, very vulnerable to the presence of organized crime, corrupt authorities in Mexico, which is where also she's going to be trying to collaborate with Mexico under, I expect, a different attitude and, you know, more of collaboration also in Mexico, other than, you know, pressure and threats and all that. So I think that she has a very important task to accomplish, but I think she's on the right track to do it.
And in terms of Mexico, what is on the agenda with AMLO?
Oh, well, I think that also the collaboration, there are different perspectives on that. And some in the country think that she will try to push Mexico in a better way to do what Donald Trump would say, which is like to protect the southern border and to collaborate, not to leave people to continue their journey to the north. I believe that it's in the interest probably of those countries to address the root causes of irregular migration. But let's see what happens in that regard. Another thing that allegedly, I mean, it's important for the United States is corruption in the Northern Triangle and Mexico and the presence of organized crime in Mexico. In that regard, I believe that, you know, having a cordial conversation, a conversation of cooperation, and also probably, recognizing shared responsibilities, and possibly an economic help to Mexico. The president of Mexico has also the idea of developing the southern states of Mexico. And probably, you know, the United States and Mexico could come up with ways to develop also the southern part of Mexico in case some of the people that cannot just like stay while waiting for their situation to be improved, that have to run because of the gangs, will probably have better opportunities in Mexico. So I think the negotiation of this economic package that the United States can give to Mexico will be key, will be very, very key. And as I said before, even though some of the media outlets in the United States or the international media see this as a very big blow against Andrés Manuel López Obrador, I am not sure about that. And Andrés Manuel is still very, very strong. So Kamala Harris is not going to face a president that is weak, and this is something important. So I think that there will be avenues of collaboration, but I think that the two countries have to give and take.
Well, just in closing, Guadalupe, we talked about the 96 candidates and politicians who have been murdered in this current campaign for the elections that just took place over the weekend, and 565 politicians or candidates were also targeted. So does that mean we know who's probably targeting him, which is the criminal gangs? So does that mean that the people who actually get elected are the ones that the criminal gangs approve of? I mean, if you're being attacked and intimidated by criminal gangs who are willing to shoot and murder brazenly, 96 candidates out of 565 that they've intimidated, doesn't that mean that the criminal gangs are deciding who gets elected in Mexico?
I don't think so. I don't think so. The events that have taken place have to do with the dynamics that have been growing, and they're a result of a process of a security strategy that has been not correct and has, you know, incorporated also, you know, the processes of corrupt processes and corrupt authorities. Absolutely, there is a problem of security, of organized crime and corruption in Mexico. There's no question about that. But putting that in a sense to say, Mexico is driven. Mexican politicians are driven by cartels. It's not correct. As I said, 2018, we had more events of the ones that you described, and this situation has not been addressed. No, it has not been addressed, and Mexico's government needs to work on that. But I would say that there is an attempt of organized crime to have an impact on elections, and we need to be very careful about that. And definitely, I don't doubt, and we know about the fact that authorities at the highest levels of government in the sexenio of Felipe Calderón, the strong man of security, Genaro García Luna, the Secretary of Public Safety, is arrested, and it is waiting for its trial in the United States for supposedly having, you know, received money from the Sinaloa cartel. And then Salvador Cienfuegos, who was also the other strong man in the next administration of Enrique Peña Nieto, was arrested in the state of California in the United States for supposedly also for alleged links with the cartel. So therefore, there are definitely links. And what happened today has a lot to do with situation in Mexico, with the connections of politicians, with the protection of organized crime by the politicians. But saying that this is like a characteristic of today's election, I want to think that there are some changes, and definitely we have to address these issues. But I don't believe that Mexico is a failed state, that the state is driven by cartels. I want to think about that. I want to think that, but I'll see. I mean, we'll see, and we have to keep an eye on what is happening. And 2024 is near, so this is going to be the real referendum on this project that might have a future or might not, which is the project of Andrés Manuel López Obrador, his approach to security and his approach to the economy and his approach to the poor in the country. One thing that he has, put very clear is that, you know, he feels that the poor people are first. And this is why he has been able to keep his support, because the support is still very, very important in the country. And yes, we have to address the issue of insecurity, the issue of organized crime. It's not minor what happened in this electoral process, but it's not the end of Mexico. This is what we have to understand too.
Well, Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, who is a professor at the Shah School of Policy and Government at George Mason University, whose research focuses on Mexico-U.S. relations, organized crime, immigration, border security, and human trafficking. A global fellow at the Wilson Center, she was recently the principal investigator of a research grant to study organized crime and trafficking in persons in Central America and along Mexico's eastern migration routes, supported by the Department of State's Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons. The president of the Association for Borderland Studies. Her latest book is Los Zetas, Inc., Criminal Corporations, Energy, and Civil War in Mexico. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the incendiary and volatile politics in Israel as Prime Minister Netanyahu borrows from Trump, accusing the opposition government about to replace him of fraud.
Politics needs votes. Politics needs your mind. Politics needs human beings. Politics needs lies. That's why.
מפנה מקום מסביב לשתיקות שלך, מפנה מקום בלב ללחיצות שלך, מפנה מקום בבטן שאוכל לבלוע אותך. אני מפנה מקום בתיבה למכתבים שלך.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Gershom Gorenberg, who's a historian and journalist who has been covering Middle East affairs for more than 35 years, a columnist for The Washington Post and a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. His books include The Unmaking of Israel, The Accidental Empire, The End of Days, Shalom, Friend, The Life and Legacy of Yitzhak Rabin, winner of the National Jewish Book Award, and most recently, War of Shadows, Codebreakers, Spies, and the Secret Struggle to Drive the Nazis from the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gershom Gorenberg.
My pleasure to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And things are heating up in Israel to the point where it's pretty unprecedented that Israel's internal security, Shin Bet, its chief, had to go public and warn that, quote, extremely violent and inciting discourse targeting lawmakers seeking to end Prime Minister Netanyahu's 12-year reign could take a potentially lethal form. So apparently already there's been demonstrators, nationalists, demonstrating in front of Naftali Bennett's house, etc., and they've had to put Shin Bet bodyguards to protect Naftali Bennett. And I'm not sure about Lapid, but this is pretty unprecedented, isn't it, that you have a situation where the outgoing prime minister is inciting violence and it requires the internal security people to issue an alert?
Yes, it is unprecedented. There have been other times of extreme political tension in Israel where the public atmosphere got extremely intense, and a couple of occasions in the past, tragically and famously, the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, where that led to violence. But I don't recall any other case of a prime minister essentially saying that for him to leave office is illegitimate, and that the people who are putting together a new government, according to the basic rules of Israeli democracy, are doing something illegitimate. And that is the desperate tactic that Netanyahu and his allies are using right now. And in particular, they are aiming their fury most strongly at the at Naftali Bennett, the leader of the small right-wing Yamina party, who is slated to become the next prime minister, and at other members of his party, because they're trying to at one time convinced the public, particularly the right-wing public, that this is, that they've sold out their voters, that they've misrepresented themselves. And they're trying, by doing that, to put extreme pressure on the lawmakers from that party not to vote for the new government. In the process, there is a serious risk, as the head of the security service said, that they could give someone the idea that violence is justified to stop us, and that's very dangerous.
Well, surely, Gershom, this echoes of what happened here in the United States on January the 6th with Donald Trump inciting the mob to storm the Capitol?
There certainly seem to be echoes of it. I have to say that usually I resist comparisons, too close of comparisons between Israeli and American politics, both because the societies are so different and because the structure of politics is so different. But in this case, Netanyahu really seems to be cribbing lines from Trump. I mean, he has referred to Bennett siding with the new coalition, with the Change Coalition, as it's normally called here, as a form of election fraud. Now what he means by that is not what Trump claimed, that the votes were miscounted. What he means by that is that Bennett defrauded his voters by saying that he'd support a right-wing government and now supporting the new across-the-board coalition, which by the way, Netanyahu falsely labels as being a left-wing coalition. But the rhetoric, calling it an election fraud, treating it as being illegitimate, that the democratic process could lead to him leaving office, that certainly looks like consciously or subconsciously Trump taking lines directly from Donald Trump.
Well, Netanyahu wrote on his Facebook page that Bennett changed government. He compared it to the Torah story about spies, quote, spies, public representatives of the Israelites who defamed the land of Israel and weakened the people's spirit only out of concern for their personal jobs. So, I don't know, that seems like incitement to me.
Well, you know, using biblical verses to prove whatever point you want to make is an old game. It's not Netanyahu's usual style, by the way, and even the posing as somebody who's so concerned about the Torah portion is if it weren't for the circumstances, would be a good source of humor. But the bottom line there is that he's describing these people as betraying their voters and at a certain level as betraying the country. The idea that people who don't vote for me are treasonous to the state as a whole is absolute poison to a democracy. And that's what Netanyahu is doing right now. He has gone all out on the idea that he is the state, and is trying every desperate tactic he can to avoid losing power.
And you mentioned earlier, Gershom Gorenberg, that the what's happening now with this incitement and the need for internal security, Shin Bet, to protect Naftali Bennett and other lawmakers in this new coalition government that's being formed, is reminiscent of what happened with the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. The former head of Shin Bet said that the current atmosphere reminds him of what happened just before Rabin's assassination. And to this day, Rabin's widow, Leah Rabin, I don't think she's still alive. So Leah Rabin, the widow of Yitzhak Rabin, always blamed Netanyahu for her husband's assassination. And he did attend rallies with far-right murderous people. And a lot of his own Likud colleagues left the rallies because they thought it was too incendiary. But Netanyahu stayed there. And it seems like he's never really taken responsibility for incitement in his entire career.
No, and I think that there is another factor here. It's the nature of this style of leadership, that there is this intense relationship between the crowd and the leader, and that the swelling feeling of the crowd inspires, gives energy to, stokes the ego of the leader. So whereas other people back in the mid-90s, 1994, 1995, when this fury was rising on the right against Rabin, other people at a certain point in the right said, this has gone too far, and walked out. Whereas as Netanyahu seemed to just thrive on the adulation of the crowd and not notice the danger he was creating. And I'll add a point there. The danger created by this is not one that vanishes the day after a new government is sworn in, if it is indeed sworn in. Netanyahu is going to remain on the political scene. He is, by the way, going to remain on trial, something which he would like to divert the public's attention from. He is desperately trying to stay at the leadership of his Likud party. And therefore, the risk of him continuing to stir up this kind of trouble remains. There's no reason to feel confident that the tension will vanish just because a new government is sworn in.
So I guess, though, in the overall picture here, this new government, if it indeed is going to form, and I guess Netanyahu's tactic at the moment, apart from inciting violence and causing internal security to have to protect his political opponents, he's also trying to peel off people from Naftali Bennett's religious nationalist party. And the coalition that Naftali Bennett's put together is an extremely unlikely one, with leftists and the Arab Islamist party, RUM, along with Jewish nationalists. And, of course, the biggest contradiction of all is Naftali Bennett being a religious nationalist and his coalition partner, Lapid, being the kind of poster boy for Israeli secularism. Didn't his party was really formed around secularism, wasn't it?
Well, his party is, I would say, the voice of the Israeli mostly secular middle class. The fact is, Lapid has always been very good. I think this is an aspect of Lapid's political personality that is often overlooked, especially abroad. Lapid has always been very good at recruiting for his party members of the moderate wing of the Orthodox society, the Orthodox community, the religious community in Israel. He's always had at least a couple of representatives on his parliamentary ticket who are religious and represent a much more moderate view politically and religiously than the kind of people who have been in Bennett's party or parties further to the right. So he hasn't been a radical secularist, certainly not in the style of his late father, but he represents a different vision of the state, a much more secular live and let live vision of the state. The coalition that has been created, by the way, hasn't really been created by Bennett. It's been created by Lapid. Lapid has been the political mastermind behind putting this together and behind creating this incredibly unlikely and sort of house of cards coalition, all in order to accomplish what he sees as the most pressing task, which is getting Netanyahu out of the prime minister's office.
But given that Lapid's party, which is its constituents are the centrists, as you mentioned, middle class, secular Jewish Israeli citizens, they want civil marriage, they want subsidized childcare, and they want buses and transport, public transport, to run on Jewish holidays. So is that ever going to fly with Bennett and company?
I think that the likelihood is that this government is extremely unlikely to make any significant changes in those kinds of issues on the religious secular status quo. What they are very likely to do is to pass a new draft law, a new conscription law, which will reduce the exemption given to the ultra-Orthodox. The ultra-Orthodox are not represented in the government, and Bennett has no problem with pushing for more of them to share the military burden or the national service burden as an alternative to military service. There could be changes made in the requirements for the ultra-Orthodox school system. But in terms of things like civil marriage or public transportation on Shabbat, on the Sabbath, basically on all of these major issues, people have had to agree to a moratorium on the major policy issues facing the country in order to create a coalition that can remove Netanyahu from power. Now, there is one thing that is written into this coalition agreement, which is very significant and is represents a change. The very fact of having a party backed by the Arab minority in the governing coalition and the moderate promises made to that party represent a significant change in Israeli politics, a positive change of political legitimation for those parties and inclusiveness. And Bennett, like it or not, has become party to that in order to gain his chance at the premiership. So that's one change that certainly seems to be taking place out of this.
So just in the last couple of minutes, Gershom, it sounds like, and this is what most of the analysts in Israel are saying, that this new government, assuming it gets formed in the next few days and reaches the point where it can be sworn in, that's not even guaranteed, and then after it's sworn in, it's obviously a very frail coalition. The conventional wisdom is that nothing is going to change with the Palestinians, that there'll be no resumption of peace talks or a two-state solution. Is that your belief as well?
Well, that looks like the most likely situation. I would underline that political predictions about Israeli politics have a remarkably poor track record. And major developments on the peace front have usually happened in a completely unexpected way. But what is true, in my view, is that if there's anything that's likely to strain this coalition to the point of breaking up, it is any outside initiative to push toward negotiations and a two-state agreement. That's the point where the different parties need to take a stand, and they would have a very difficult time agreeing on what that stand is. They will be nervous about such initiatives. But there's another aspect of this, which is it's not just a matter of negotiations. It's a matter of what goes on in the day-to-day. On the one hand, I unfortunately don't see a situation where this government is going to take any significant action to slow down settlement construction. On the other hand, it is possible, for instance, that it will be able to exert much stronger control over the police force, which has become highly politicized under Netanyahu, and reduce the amount or the number of clashes with Palestinians in East Jerusalem, for instance. If there's an improvement, it will be around the edges. If there's a major challenge on the diplomatic front, that could be what would break up the coalition.
Well, Gershom Gorenberg, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Gershom Gorenberg, who's an historian and journalist who's been covering Middle East affairs for more than 35 years, a columnist for The Washington Post and a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. His books include The Unmaking of Israel, The Accidental Empire, The End of Days, Shalom, Friend, The Life and Legacy of Yitzhak Rabin, the winner of the National Jewish Book Award, and most recently, War of Shadows, Codebreaker, Spies, and the Secret Struggle to Drive the Nazis from the Middle East. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.